also noted the issues you have raised, which are which they fall within themselves, so that as they present also, they can help us on the questions you have raised in terms of how can we move forward. You can continue to respond on the issue.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'd just like to note that a large chunk of our presentation is actually based on a book chapter on print media transformation, which is coming out in the latest New South African Review. It will be out at the end of this month, but we did send the PDF a couple of days ago as part of our presentation, but it sounds like it hasn't arrived. Now, on the question from Honourable Killen about what are other democracies doing to ensure that people are represented, and what are the nature of regulatory measures? What are the nature of regulatory measures that have been adopted in other countries to ensure diversity? Now, you know, I don't have a very comprehensive answer to this question because.
Sorry, Ms. Duncan. Can we please have the door closed? You can proceed.
Yes, I don't have a very comprehensive answer to that question because obviously this is exactly the kind of work that needs to be done in order to prepare properly for a hearing of this nature. But there are two broad areas in which democratic governments generally intervene in media, more specifically in print media, because obviously the conditions in broadcast media and the conditions in print media differ. And these areas of intervention are, if you could put it like this, democratically permissible. And the one area is in relation to subsidies. And one has seen a number of countries, including South Africa, introducing subsidy schemes in order to subsidize small commercial and community media. Probably, you know, the best known and widely studied example is Sweden, that has two forms of subsidy. One is there are either direct subsidies, which come directly from the parliament, and in Sweden the emphasis has tended to be on funding what are known as secondary newspapers in small towns, because it's recognised that it's extremely difficult for newspapers other than the primary newspaper, particularly in smaller markets, to be able to survive on an ongoing basis. So generally, direct subsidies have been provided to secondary newspapers. There's also indirect subsidies as well, which includes support for things like printing and advertising and distribution, as well as may also include tax breaks too. There's a lot of debate about the success or otherwise of the Swedish subsidy scheme, but I think that there's a lot to learn from it in terms of combining direct and indirect subsidies to be able to assist newspapers. Because clearly, you know, one of the things that small newspapers, one of the problems that small newspapers experience is affordable access to the means to print and the means to distribute. And I think that's a very key area that needs to be addressed going forward. So that's the first area of permissible intervention, I think, in a democratic society. The second area, slightly more controversial, but nevertheless critically important, is around regulation of ownership in order to prevent excessive concentration of media ownership. Obviously, under conditions of globalization, this has become a particularly acute problem. And I think that more and more democracies are realizing the fact that in order to realize freedom of expression and the right to communicate, that the excessive concentration needs to be limited in order to promote diversity of opinion, and that the monopolization of opinion by single voices or a few voices can present a substantial threat to the health of a democracy. So that's the second area that's been increasingly recognized as an area of legitimate intervention for legislators. You know, obviously a number of countries have been grappling with what I mentioned earlier, which are anti-concentration measures that would in turn place a cap on how large the major newspaper groups should grow. A related issue that legislators are grappling with as well is whether to limit foreign ownership as well. In the interests of preserving cultural integrity and national diversity of opinion. So that's also an area that legislators are certainly grappling with. Now, obviously, as I pointed out earlier, you're not really going to be able to successfully legislate the question of how large or, you know, how large is too large for media groups. You're not going to be able to deal with that successfully until you answer the prior question of how do you measure diversity? Once you answer that question, then you can start to ask the question, well, how should media ownership be structured in order to achieve the levels of diversity that you want to have in that particular country? Now, France is quite an interesting case because they've obviously decided that for democratic reasons, they are going to place a limit on concentration of newspapers. But given that France is, and I think you were alluding to this, honourable member, given that France tends to be more, linguistically homogenous, in a country like South Africa, I think that the case could even be stronger, actually, for control of excessive concentration, precisely because we live in a linguistically extremely complex country. It's been extremely difficult, particularly for community newspapers that publish in the marginalized languages, to survive. There's one newspaper, for instance, in Mpumalanga that up until quite recently has been publishing in Shivenda, Shitonga, and Fana. And they have actually had to discontinue their publication in Shivenda and Shitonga because they just haven't been able to afford it. So, you know, publication in marginalized languages is extremely difficult. So I think in view of that, we have an even stronger case to make, potentially, than France for the need to limit concentration. Now, the trends in relation to ownership, why do we seem to have gone backwards in terms of ownership diversity? I think the reasons are quite complex. A lot of it had to do with the peculiar macroeconomic conditions of the late 1990s with the adoption of the Growth, Employment and Redistribution Plan that led to the cost of credit going up, and given that a lot of empowerment groups, the women's groups, the trade union groups and the black empowerment groups and what have you, tended to be funded by debt rather than equity, it made it extremely difficult for those groups to survive. So I think the macroeconomic environment and what was happening with interest rates and the cost of credit had a very serious impact on the ability of those groups to maintain their foothold in the ownership of the newspaper groups. Hence, we had that reconsolidation taking place in the early 2000s. The NDBA and the role of the NDBA. You know, speaking personally, I was part of the, and I think a number of us were, part of the very initial discussions around the establishment of the NDDA and were part of the whole process of the establishment of the NDDA and what have you. And one of the things that I think we need to do also as part of the process that's been initiated by Parliament is to have a comprehensive review of the NDDA and the extent to which it's actually impacted on the media development and diversity picture. Because although, you know, the NDDA has been reporting on an annual basis about its work, I don't think we necessarily have a full comprehensive understanding of the impact that it's had on the media diversity picture since its inception. And I think that's quite critical. I think there's very little doubt in our minds that the NGDA is underfunded, and you know that's one of the mandates that we're coming with to this hearing. We certainly want to argue for increased funding for the NGDA, but at the same time, we also need to evaluate what the NGDA is doing and whether how the NGDA is conceptualized is actually up to the task, if you like, of realizing media diversity. Because just to reiterate a point that I made earlier, that if you're just simply going to subsidize while leaving the fundamental market structure intact, you're not doing enough. You're not doing enough because you're just plowing money into a situation where the structural conditions that disadvantage small commercial and community media remain. And funding alone and limited grants at that are not necessarily going to address those particular structural problems. And it's the structural problems, I think, that we need to pinpoint, we need to identify them and understand exactly how to deal with them. So can they do more? I think the fact that the NGDA, I think in 2009, if I'm not mistaken, initiated this research project in order to understand, you know, the extent to which the media has transformed, I think is very welcome. But, you know, frankly, we shouldn't be at this stage now where we're grappling to answer the question to what extent has the media transformed. We should have a clear answer. And I think that, you know, the NGDA also needs to play an advocacy role as well in helping us to understand where we are as a country with respect to the transformation of media and what needs to be done in order to ensure that the media becomes more transformed than where we are at the moment. And I've still got to see the NGDA playing that kind of strong advocacy role in relation to media diversity. And admittedly, its mandate is limited, and perhaps its mandate needs to be revisited in order to ensure that it plays a stronger role. The push by the bigger media groups to take over the small media, that's certainly something that we've picked up on, particularly in the outlying areas. And that's certainly a concern for us. What are we doing about it? Well, we're attempting to understand the extent of the problem. We have been speaking, you know, directly, for instance, to AIP members in order to understand how badly affected they are. What are the problems that make the competitive environment so difficult? And so we're at that stage at the moment of attempting to understand the problem. Also, the Right to Know campaign, because it's a popular campaign, have been signing up to community media groups as members and will obviously continue to do that. Do we consider ourselves to be the voice of these small community newspapers? Well, they already have one voice, which is the Association for Independent Newspapers. But certainly to the extent that these newspapers are struggling to survive, and to the extent that has an impact on the free flow of information in the country, which in turn impacts negatively on the Right to Know, certainly their problems need to be our problems, and we need to take them on board. The Honourable Member asked the question about how would we have liked to see this Indaba being convened. Well, we certainly would have liked more time in order to prepare. It's just more of a happy coincidence than anything else that there was a book chapter that we could draw on. But in order to really do a question like this justice, we would have liked to have the space to be able to do precisely the kind of research that Honourable Killian is alluding to, about what measures have been implemented by other countries and how well have they worked in order to realize diversity. You know, these kinds of questions can't be rushed. To an extent, they're also new questions for South Africa as well. So we certainly needed a lot more time to prepare. We would have loved as many community groups to have been involved as possible. So the very small community and commercial newspapers that we've been speaking about, there are a number of groups here that will be presenting, but if they had had an opportunity, I think, to be able to prepare themselves to come and speak directly about their own experiences, I think that would have been quite illuminating, actually, for the committee, because then you could hear about the practical problems with attempting to stay in the market that have been experienced by people on the ground. Perhaps that's something that the committee can consider doing in future. So that you can hear directly from the horse's mouth, if you could put it like that. I don't recall us saying that we don't have a free press, Honourable van der Berg. I think that you can own up to that particular.
I do own up to that. I was quoting the Freedom House annual report on freedom of the press, and they do say that we don't have a free press in this country. They have three ratings, not free, partly free, and free. And we're currently in the partly free category. If you look at the Freedom House report, there's a number of reasons why they say that. They have something called the Freedom of the Press Index. Just for the record, the two African countries that are listed as having an entirely free press are Mali and Ghana. The Freedom of the Press Index that Freedom House uses measures a number of different things to gauge whether or not a press in a certain country is free. And I must just say this is the Freedom House's position, it's not RTK's position. But it's worth taking a look at because they've done the research. They look at things like the degree of print, broadcast and internet freedom. They also look at, quite interestingly, how much of a population in a particular country has access to what types of media, which I think is a particular concern here because you can't claim to have a free press if no one reads it. So they look at that, and what they also look at, which is interesting, is they examine the political discourse surrounding press freedom in each particular country. In South Africa, this would mean that they, and if you look at their report, they have been looking at things such as the Protection of Information Bill, now called the Protection of State Information Bill, which the Right to Know campaign has been quite vocal about recently, and the fact that it still has a lack of a public interest defense clause. It's perceived widely to be a threat to journalistic freedoms, especially for investigative journalists, and it's affected our free press rating globally. Another one of the things that they cite in their report is the ruling party's investigation of the media accountability mechanisms. And I'm not allowed to talk about that today, but I was asked the question, so I'm talking about it now.
Don't talk about that.
Okay.
It's not started for discussion today.
Okay. No, I know.
The one who asked the question, maybe it was a slip of a tongue. Okay, but don't go into that.
Okay. I won't go into that, but the question was, why don't we have a free press? And that is one of the reasons why why our rating has slipped. In 2009, South Africa was listed as having an entirely free press rating. But for the years 2010 and 2011, we've slipped to only party free. So that's problematic. But the report is on the website, so if you want to give it a read, you can do that. Another question that we received was in terms of people on the ground, grassroots communities that are represented badly in the press. And then the issue of only receiving a very small, insufficient apology in the newspaper a few days later, buried in the classifieds or something. This has been a constant complaint, that the representation of the apology or the correction doesn't necessarily meet the harm that was done. Now, this is something that's been debated at length during the Press Council's process of review, and so it's not something that's going unnoticed. In the Press Council review report that they released in August, they've made recommendations on this. So this committee can look into those recommendations if that is a concern. And also in terms of, I think someone, another concern was that these people don't necessarily have the money to complain when the communities are badly represented in newspapers. It doesn't cost anything to lay a complaint with the South African Press Ombudsman. It's free. So, do I have that right? It doesn't cost a thing. So you don't need money to lay a complaint against a newspaper. You also don't need money to write to the editor of the newspaper and complain with him as well. And in terms of, just encouraging this practice amongst local communities and communities who feel that they have been badly represented by the press, the review report that the Press Council released last month recommends that the structure of the Press Council be changed slightly to include the role of a public advocate. And this is the person that is going to hopefully increase awareness amongst communities such as that, and also act as a mediator between the Press Council's office and the complainant. So the Press Council has discussed these things. They've taken submissions, I think 58 different submissions from various people across the country, and they've included all of this feedback in the report. So it's been addressed and it's been debated at quite a lot of length. I think that's all of my questions.
Thank you very much, Honourable Trox and Honourable van der Weg, Honourable Killen.
Thank you, Chairperson. One honourable member asked a question, and I'm not sure if it was answered. You said in the beginning that some people are not here. Who are they that not here at this meeting? So if Parliament do have challenges, many people that can't afford to come and make a presentation to do a briefing to this committee, that's why we're doing oversight committees. For example, small community newspapers. Maybe you can just give us a list and tell us who should have been here and who have not been covered, and then can you just mention and who have not been mentioned that should have been here. Thank you.
Honourable Pandava.
I just want to ask the chairperson my question. I ask, what would change? Will we have a free press or whatever if ownership changed?
Honourable Killen.
I'm covered, thank you.
Thank you. The other thing, Nondava.
I would like to state for the record that as members of this committee, we are concerned about the issue of transformation of the media, including the transformation of ownership. To the extent that when we do our oversight work, and we actually go and visit the small media entities that the MTDA has actually helped to establish, it's okay. We understand that the MTDA is underfunded. We have complained, some of us have expressed that sentiment here. Mm-hmm. But a start had to be made somewhere. But from where we sit, we really appreciate the work that the MTTA has been able to do within the limited scope of resources at their disposal. We understand the problem that small community newspapers face, and community radio stations for that matter. The day-to-day struggle to survive, which is why we paid them a visit to try and understand their problem. And the, part of the reason why we have actually called for this summit is because in the structure of the MTTA, the established media, including the Big Four that were listed there, are supposed to be contributing towards this transformation. And our impression, according to the reports that we have received, are that the contribution by the established media are far from satisfactory. Now, that is part of the structural problem that we would like to see addressed. Secondly, part of the established media houses are actually accused of going around to actually snuff out even the weekly community newspapers that has been established to try and encourage diversity. That is the problem that we have in mind. And so, I'm not sure, Chairperson, whether the Big Four are around here in this room, whether they are represented, because we would have loved to hear their voices as well, juxtaposed or responding to the cries of the small entities. You see, on a day-to-day basis, not only a question of being able to attract adverts to survive, it even goes to the extent of where do you go to print? They don't have the freedom, for example, to say, I want my newspaper to be out in the street on a month-to-month basis. But because there is monopoly of ownership, even of the printing houses, their newspapers are not actually out in the street on a regular basis. Those are the kind of reports we have received down there from these small entities for which the MTTA is responsible. So we thought that this meeting would bring together these two entities from across the divide so that we could say, Icona, we need to redress the problem that there is in this country, in keeping, mind you, with the sentiments of our constitution, because the MTTA is not just a body that was established to exist, maybe because it's a nice to have. It's an imperative of the constitution. Media diversity is an imperative of the Constitution. I know that a cacophony of voices, particularly towards the media, especially the dominant media, dominates the scene. The moment there is move towards achieving this diversity by legislating it, I mean, there would be hullabaloo, there would be an outcry. But at this point in time, we're trying to engage all of them because we are in between. We're trying to say what could be done, what is the responsibility of those who are established. We know that historically they came about. It's not entirely a question of if people don't want to buy your pocket of fish and chips, they go away. There is a very controversial history, actually spanning even why my fish and chips cannot be bought we're trying to say, Chairperson, we should not be diverted from actually the core function of this meeting. That is what we're trying to do. We acknowledge the fact that maybe the time was short. We couldn't accommodate all the voices. But this is a start. But we do want to see here a demonstration that the established media exercise this responsibility, because media diversity is an imperative of the Constitution. It's not just a nice to have. That is what we want to address. We acknowledge, for example, the submission that has been given by the Right to Know campaign, that we shouldn't rely on the competition, for example, competition commission and legislation, and on the triple B as an adequate measurement of whether there is enough transformation. That is interesting. We acknowledge that one. It gives us food for thought. But really, that is where we need to begin, so that people at a local level, communities, whatever formation, can also enjoy this right and freedom of expression to the fullest extent that the Constitution imagines. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Nondaba. Honorable Killen.
Chairperson, just saying from what Honorable Nondaba said, what is it, if media ownership is changed, I think Professor Duncan has indicated that we actually need to have clarity about how we're going to measure it. Because ultimately, if you want to regulate dominance and you want to ensure that you actually promote participatory democracy, which is what we need to do through print media and electronic media, how do you balance the different constitutional rights in such an extent that you do it as parliament, which is promoting a multiplicity of ideas, if you could attend to that. And then the other issue was, is the lack of transformation, we're dealing with print media today, but I'm also having an analysis of some of the radio stations, and that is of equal concern, because, Chairperson, according to the schedule, we've seen 100% movement towards black ownership, but we still see 100% male dominance. Yes, I see that Chairperson is smiling about it, but that is also a reality, and I think if Professor Duncan and they could also comment on that, how do you achieve that as well in this process? Thank you.
Thank you very much. You've got a question. You can respond to the question. But one issue which I wanted to check with you is that the funding of MTDA, the current pay-as-you-go. You see, the current one is pay-as-you-go. Someone has raised it. You pay as you go, how much you afford a time for 30 rand or 15 rand, then you contribute. Because I'm sure we've also raised the issue in terms of the funding, because I think to a certain extent, as we have raised it, that maybe that constrain MTDA to do its work and so on. But again, if you can just a little bit, not that much, to indicate in terms of the current mandate for MTDA, because you see, the reason I'm sure Honorable Zond has just said a mouthful in terms of why we've called you to come, despite anything else, but we seem to be starting to understand some of the challenges in the print media and what are the issues we need to deal with. What do you think? think you need to fundamentally change in the current mandate of MTDA. I will tell you why is that more often when MTDA take up issues, there is a threat of funding. I normally talk to them and then say, why are you not engaging on this matter? You see that they themselves sometimes are biting their hands that keep, you know, there is also that reluctance and other things and so on. Maybe probably this pay as you go and when a person can contribute or not contribute and so on as a threat. But I just want to, if you can, in terms of what exactly which we need to unlock on the current mandate. Because it will seem also the mandate current of MTDA is also limiting to a certain extent. You see, they don't seem to be in a position to lead the transformation. They are more in a position to advocate for and then deal with these other things. So whether you share that view or you got another perspective. Honorable Killen?
Chair, just on that issue, also, what other measures can government do? If we review MDDA, it's going to perhaps take some time. What other mechanisms can government do to assist community basis? And do you believe that the current communications plan of government to promote information is working through a singular paper, although sort of in different languages, but of which the distribution is still not being conducted? Do you believe that is the right one, or should they rather promote diversity also through direct advertisement? And what are the obstacles that those local community members are facing in terms of upfront funding to place advertisements, and then government funding only comes in later? If you could deal with that as well, thank you.
You can talk.
I've got all the questions. In relation to the question about who is not here, well, I think what we'd like to see, what would I think be of enormous value, is to have the grassroots newspapers themselves here who can speak directly about conditions on the ground. And I think the Honourable Member made a very interesting suggestion about actually having an arrangement where these newspapers can speak about the publishing conditions that they're facing and the difficulties that they're facing, and having the Big Four responding to that.
Maybe to help you, Ms. Duncan, what is your sexual saying? We're already engaged. Our oversight in Eastern Cape, KZN, and Northern Cape, Free State, and one who is supposed to, we are talking to them directly. Hence, even to come here, part of the issue, what they are raising when we direct here, the committee, and get them to us.
Okay. I think the next question is, will we have a free press if ownership changes, or more free press? Because I think the thing about the Freedom House figures is that we have been downgraded from free to party free, not from free to not free. So will we have a more free press if ownership changes? Not necessarily, no. Because I think the conditions that have given rise to the downgrade in Freedom House's estimation, I think is the kind of measures that have caused alarm recently around media freedom, which is obviously the Protection of Information Bill and the possibility of statutory regulations through the establishment of a media appeals tribunal. I think all of these have raised concerns. There have also been measures that have impacted negatively on the independence of the communications regulator, ICASA, as well. So I think all of these things Freedom House has taken into account, and those things won't necessarily go away if we, change one set of owners with another set of owners. Those measures would still need to be addressed. But at the same time, I don't think we're emphasizing ownership change purely and simply. But what we are advocating for is diversification of ownership. Because otherwise what you can do is substitute one set of owners for another set of owners, but you're not necessarily changing usual practices. and you're not necessarily creating an environment where a greater diversity of voices are heard within those media organizations that are experiencing ownership changes. So unless ownership changes result in substantial newsroom practices, changes in newsroom practices, unless we see an increase in the voice of women, for instance, an increase in the representation of people in rural areas, for instance, we're not necessarily going to get to the kind of diversity that we need. Honourable Killian has raised the question of if media ownership is changed, how do you balance different constitutional rights? And I assume what you are referring to there is the constitutional right of the owners to own what they own, relative to the constitutional right of citizens to freedom of expression. Well, I think one of the ways in which one strikes that particular balance is to ask the question, what is the minimum tolerable level of concentration that one needs in a particular society in order to strike that particular balance, and what is the minimum level of what is the concentration threshold that is tolerable in our society to ensure that the constitutional rights to freedom of expression is actually realized. I think the key to striking that particular balance is the ownership cap that I was talking about earlier. As I said, there's no magic formula, there's no magic bullet that we can use in order to determine what the most appropriate cap is. But the point is, let's start a process of engaging with what that is, which will take us into the international debate about what are appropriate levels of concentration and diversity. And only once the debate matures, I think, will we be able to answer the question of the appropriate balancing of the rights which you're alluding to. We haven't even started out on that particular debate, but I think let's start now. But there are other things I think that need to happen in order to realize this ideal of diversity that we started out our presentation with. So for instance, you know, one sees a dominance within journalism of the professional model and the dominance of the commercial model of media. There are very few non-commercial spaces for media production in our country. The public broadcaster, in spite of the fact that it's meant to be a public broadcaster, is funded almost entirely from an advertising base, which skews its own programming and its own reporting towards upper income groups. I mean, it's inevitably an income, it's inevitably a consequence of relying overwhelmingly on advertising as a source of income. And given that we live in one of the most unequal societies in the world, over-reliance on advertising as a source of income for media creates those kinds of distortions, if you like, in who gets represented and inevitably how we see ourselves and how we see our own social problems. So I think unless and until we attend very seriously to how to build in non-commercial spaces for media. I don't think we're going to be able to give a voice adequately to voices that are underrepresented in our media system. We've allowed the professional model of journalism, and there are many competing models of journalism that are out there, but we've allowed the professional model of journalism and the commercial model of media production to dominate overwhelmingly our media system. And I think given the kind of country that we are and the development challenges that we have, I think that's inappropriate. In relation to the NDDA and what needs to change, we haven't taken a position on this particular issue. Obviously, the right to know campaign that we're still discussing it. But One of the debates that happened historically in the community media movement is whether it was appropriate to have a voluntary funding arrangement for the NVDA. Because the dangers of a voluntary arrangement is that the groups who are contributing voluntarily can decide to not contribute voluntarily. And I think the whole basis on which the NVDA has been set up historically is that there is good faith. It's a partnership between industry, community media, and the NVDA. And one of the things I think we need to evaluate in the course of these discussions is whether that partnership is actually working. And one of the things that needs to be entertained, you know, in the course of doing that evaluation is whether it's not more appropriate to have a legislated funding mechanism. So, for instance, there are some countries that have a tax on advertising, for instance, that's then used to cross-subsidize community and small commercial media. I think we also need to have that kind of debate as well. Is it appropriate to leave the funding of the NVDA purely to a voluntary arrangement? I think we need to, 12 years down the line, or 11 years down the line, I think we need to revisit that fairly fundamental question that the community media sector had raised right at the start, because the sector had significant concerns about the dangers of just simply having a voluntary funding arrangement. I don't know whether I
understand the question. The mandate, what do you think with MTDA? I assume the reviewing, if we review everything, include the mandate. But currently,
advocacy. You know, MTDA needs to play a stronger role in being an advocate of media development and diversity. So, for instance, you know, the MTDA should have been in a position already to be able to critique there seem to be these serious structural problems that community media are facing and why the competition authorities don't seem to have addressed those particular structural problems adequately. I think we should have arrived at these hearings with a far more refined sense of what the nature of structural logjams are in the realization of media diversity than we have at the moment.
Thank you very much. Okay. Thanks very much. I think your presentation gave us a lot of thinking to do. You have raised issues, you have raised possible solutions, you have raised pointed what might be the policy direction which you might prefer, and the proposal in terms of what we must do ourselves as here in Parliament in terms of articulating the issues. Thanks very much again. We are done. Yes, I'm told. It is said, how did you find it? What do I give? I believe you are a box fan. It's fine. Like all of us. Or what do you tweet? Are you tweeting? Are you tweeting? I had a request. From Association of Independent Publishers. I'm told that when they were making a presentation, it was half presentation. There was another part of the presentation. I then responded to say because they didn't finish the hour, they only have some time left. If they insist that they want to present the second part, I can allow them to do so. Can you finalize the last part? But you had only 15 minutes remaining from your first presentation. Do you want... okay. You'll just be talking to the presentation. We don't have slides. No, you can carry on. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
My colleague, the executive director of the Association of Independent Publishers, had presented the first part, which basically addresses what AIP is all about, the facts and the figures concerning its history and its membership and the general landscape of the association's members. The part of the presentation that I'd like to focus on is more the engagement inside of the industry and with state institutions. And I'd like to just start off by speaking to the actual briefing that we received about a week ago. AIP queries the PCC's rationale for the Indaba. On one hand, the rationale appears to be based on the perceived weaknesses with respect to the stance of journalism and the government's inquiry into media accountability mechanisms in order to balance the rights enshrined in the Constitution. On the other hand, the Indaba calls for a debate on diversity and transformation in the media in light of these perceived weaknesses. AIP fails to see any direct relevance between the journalistic and media freedom issues on the one hand and economic issues on the other. The two issues are to a large extent mutually exclusive. Transformation within the industry is a matter of commerce and economics and should not embrace journalistic standards and press freedom. AIP's mandate is the issue of business sustainability. The debate on transformation and diversity should address the benchmarks with respect to the BEE Act, which includes ownership, management control, employment equity, skills development, preferential procurement, enterprise development, and socio-economic development. And these issues should be neither confused nor conflated with a debate on the standards of journalism, such as editorial content, quality of reporting, freedom of expression, and freedom of the press, which are very, very important. We'd like to define the issues from a very peculiar AIP perspective, and we see that the key challenge in this process is the defining of the issues and the clarifying of our position. We believe that AIP and its interests are marginalized and relegated often due to clarity of key issues and due to a lack of the clarity of key issues by the major stakeholders in the industry. As an affiliate of the CNSA, AIP is recognized as an industry association representing the interests of independent grassroots publishers. AIP has a seat on the PMSA board and engages with this board to communicate matters that concern its members. AIP secretariat is also housed at the PMSA offices, and it currently benefits from a small PMSA grant for the appointment of an administrator. However, AIP also remains dependent on donor funding to sustain its operations and fulfill its mandate to its members. This includes securing funding for the running of the association's office, the above-mentioned projects that Louise has alluded to, and finding ways in which to sustain the most important revenue stream of its members, namely advertising. The landscape of the grassroots press has been significantly eroded since 2008. As stated above, in the struggle for survival, approximately 43 publications have perished, firstly due to diminishing advertising revenues, secondly due to unsustainable competition from publications owned by the major media groups, and thirdly as a result of skills deficits in respect of business management. Remember, these are micro-entrepreneurs and they are a marginalized sector of the media industry. I'd like to address now the AIP's position with respect to the state and state institutions. While we are committed to engage independently with the relevant private sector entities like PMSA to secure the survival and the growth of the members, we also seek to engage government and agencies like the NDDA on critical issues affecting the grassroots sector. The following is a summary of some of the key issues and opportunities in respect of the entities in relation to government. The first is the BEE Act and the BEE Codes of Good Practice. AIP members are generally not required to comply with the above Act and the industry code. They are exempted from the code due to their status as micro-enterprises with annual turnovers of less than 5 million rand. However, AIP seeks clarification from the relevant entities like the Department of Trade and Industry on the application and interpretation of the Act and the Codes of Practice, the Codes of Good Practice. In particular, does transformation in the print media industry in terms of the codes also include transformation, also include diversity with respect to the empowerment of largely black-owned micro-entrepreneurs who may be vulnerable to competition with corporate operators in the industry? Secondly, does the DE code include protection for any other kind of benefit for grassroots micro-entrepreneurs in a competitive industry? And thirdly, does the application of Code 600, which is intended to assist and accelerate the economic development of micro or small BE enterprises, include material support such as infrastructure development for grassroots publishers? AIP also notes that the PMSA is independently engaging with the PCC with a view to present the print media industry's transformation roadmap either tomorrow or at the next stage. There are other institutions like the MAC Transformation Charter, which speaks specifically to the marketing, advertising, and communication industries. We are interested in a charter that is more biased towards the interest of grassroots, marginalized print media institutions. As far as the NBDA is concerned, I'm glad that Jane Duncan and others have commented on the role of the NBDA and how its role can be diversified to embrace a greater range of concerns in the media industry. Whilst the NBDA is an important stakeholder in government's media development and diversity initiatives and has begun to record notable successes in this respect, the biggest challenge for this agency remains adequate funding and support for the grassroots print sector. The community, which is grassroots oriented, the print media budget of the NBDA is a minuscule $4.4 million and is not sufficient to sustain the overwhelming number of print projects that are applying for funding every year. AIP calls for a serious review of the NBDA budget allocation for print media projects and for representation on the budget committee in order to make some input in this process. There's the issue about the role of the GCIS as well, the Government Communications and Information System. AIP is concerned that the GCIS annual advertising budget of 1 billion rand, is exclusively dedicated to ad spend in the major media houses of South Africa. And when I say major media houses, I'm including those publications that are referred to as community newspapers, but are not grassroots newspapers. They're not AIP members. If the government is serious about supporting transformation and diversity in media, then a review of this process is an urgent priority. In addition to advertising procurement, AIP calls for an opportunity to explore policy initiatives for sustained and measured government advertising supplement programs that will not erode the existing revenue of grassroots publishers. Remember, grassroots publishers currently do enjoy some form of advertising from local municipalities and from the provincial government. We would expect that if there should be further investment by government into grassroots newspapers, that revenue would not be affected. In this way, the grassroots print sector can be adopted as an official vehicle for featuring the work of government departments. This revenue stream will primarily comprise funds from the media, marketing and advertising and communications budgets of the respective government departments. Another strategy is the use of special supplements in the indigenous language grants expressed by the Department of Education to promote indigenous languages. The local newspaper is the most accessible means for indigenous language speakers to engage with the language. With the support of government, such joint projects can benefit both indigenous language speakers and AIP members. As far as the Department of Trade and Industry is concerned, the DTI's BBEE initiative has intrinsic merit, but AIP seeks to explore opportunities in respect of development funding. This includes investigating if AIP as an industry association or individual AIP members are eligible for benefits under programs like the DTI's Black Business Supply Development Program. This, the sectors, the sector training Education and Training Associate Agencies of Government, AIP sees that the MathSeeter has been disbanded and that publishers now belong to neither the to either the MixSeeter or the Fiber and Paper Manufacturing Seeter. AIP is in the process of applying to both seeters for bursary and internships. This directly supports the core activity of publishers and contributes to media transformation and diversity. In conclusion, I'd like to thank the PCC for giving us a second opportunity to make this presentation, and we hope that this kind of engagement is a step towards media transformation and diversity and towards the program of action.
Thank you very much for the second bite. We are going to take a second bite for questions. Everything is second. Honorable Drogen, Honorable Killen. Drogen.
Thank you for your presentation. I just want to double check. Is your presentation that you're speaking from now in the first presentation? Do we have a copy of the presentation?
Yes, it is part of the first presentation.
Okay, my question is, we hear a lot about community newspapers saying they don't have advertisements to sustain the revenue. So we also hear the high cost of printing the community newspapers. There's also an increase, obviously, in the petrol cost for the distribution of those community newspapers. Okay, so that is what we're hearing from the community. Is that affecting the community? What is the alternative that we can look at in sustaining these community newspapers? Thanks.
Honorable Kling.
Thank you, Chair. Can we just have a better understanding of the practical problems that grassroots publishers are encountering as far as carrying government ad spend, the difficulties of surviving, you know, the balance, because from the earlier presentation by Ms. Vale, it was evident that there's also a problem that they don't always have a proper engagement with the local authorities, district, and that on occasion there is a reluctance to get further government advertisements if they are critical. So could you perhaps just also represent that view in view of the fact that government can fulfill a major role in supporting grassroots publishers with diversified views of South Africa? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Members. As far as the first question is concerned, if I understand it correctly, it addresses the challenges with respect to printing and transport. As far as printing is concerned, it's one of the major cost drivers for any publishing house, and that includes newspapers. Grassroots newspapers are dependent on either the local press, and most of us print in tabloids, and the costs there usually have to be borne by grassroots publishers paid to some of the commercial publishers, paid to our competitors. So they usually print our newspapers, and there some of our members actually complain that there is the kind of marginalization there too of our newspapers when they go into print. So that's a practical difficulty, if I may speak to the first question in particular. As far as transport is concerned, I think what the Honourable Member means there, it's referring to distribution costs. Those are very high costs as well. And normally, if we don't make use of a commercial distributor, again, that's a service which is provided by a company that is either owned by or that is contracted to a large media house, then we have to rely on a smaller distributor. Again, the same kind of disadvantages that we'd find in printing. As far as the second question is concerned, I think some of those issues I've already discussed, but coming back to certain practical problems that the Honourable Member was referring to, government advertising is one. We're always struggling to find a middle ground for government to be able to say to the grassroots sector that you are an appropriate vehicle for us to place our advertising in. And also for us to find a middle ground to speak to government, to the local government, as well as to provincial government and to national government, to be able to find space in our newspapers for them to advertise, especially during special occasions like the elections, local municipal elections, and to place advertisements for human resources needs of government. I think those are the kinds of needs areas that we are looking at. Skills development and infrastructure development and human resources, particularly in the newsroom, these are serious issues that small publishers need to address. And I think through our programs that have already been alluded to in our first part of the presentation, we've made some major inroads, especially when it comes to publications that help to develop newsroom skills, toolkits, and the kind of training that is needed for journalists to be able to say that they are professional journalists, even though they are working for grassroots newspapers.
Thank you very much. Switch off your mic, please. Thank you very much for the second bite. But I must say I find it interesting that a local newspaper in Eastern Cape, traveling a huge or large of kilometers to KZN, Durban, for printing, and drive back and still is cheaper than printing in the Eastern Cape. So I find it interesting when we're doing the oversight, when they can tell you that if you take the kilometers, all costs included, to drive to KZN and back to Eastern Cape, and still it makes economic sense for them to go to KZN to print, because they cannot afford to print on the printers in the province. I don't know how the price structure looks like and so on. I hope others, maybe as they present, they will be able to explain that anomaly, because I find it very interesting. How does that happen? Thanks very much for your presentation. Competition Committee? Your system is too sophisticated, and they don't normally work here. We do have your hard copy. Maybe you can start going to whilst the analog talk to digital. They'll find us along the way. You can start your presentation using your hard copy.
Thank you, Chair and honourable members. Good afternoon to the audience as well. I want to take this opportunity, firstly, to thank the committee for inviting the Commission to come and present its views. I think, firstly, before I even start the presentation, I would like to introduce myself. I'm Oliver Josey, and my colleague here is Hadin Razisusu, and we are, to place on the record, we are from the Competition Commission. Just before we kind of start with our presentation, having listened to some of the previous speakers, I think it's very important for us to present the kind of competition landscape and how the print media fits into that landscape within South Africa. So we'll spend a few minutes just painting the kind of landscape, and then my colleague will speak more specifically to some of the complaints we are investigating in this particular sector. It's a pity we don't have the PowerPoint working as yet, but it's fine. I think the first few slides, I think one can follow the kind of argument going forward. I think what's very, very important is, given the kind of competition landscape in South Africa, and I think it's important to note that the legislation is plus minus 10 years old, so one can safely say that we are not as mature in terms of other jurisdictions in the world as far as regulation of competition is concerned. If one gives the example of the U.S., those legislation is probably about plus minus 120 years old. So one would assume that it's an evolving branch of law in South Africa. And it's also fraught with many challenges. And I'll allude during my presentation to some of the challenges of competition law as well. Now, broadly, the kind of mandate of the Commission is basically to promote and maintain competition in the country. And there are a number of outcomes that we kind of look for in our daily work. And some of it is, for example, you know, issues around promoting the efficiency and the development of the economy. I just read one of the newspaper articles now, and I saw at the recent Cabinet Lepatla, the President spoke about creating commission for infrastructure and for job creation as well. And I think these are some of the issues that the Commission kind of looks for as outcomes in our work. The other important outcome is looking at customer choices as well, giving them many choices, and giving them choices around not just product but around pricing as well. The third issue is employment. We've seen in recent merger cases, in particular the Walmart case, we find that public interest issues, especially around employment, has come to the fore, and many interveners has placed that on record as well. The other important kind of outcome as well is making sure that SMEs and people from the previously disadvantaged groups are equally represented in the economy, and that we are able to help them to grow in the economy as well. And another important outcome is participation in world markets. We know that world markets are tough, especially for our firms, and I think we try to help as far as possible to make sure that our firms are able to compete internationally as well. And in the next slide, I'll speak a lot about how we find jurisdictions in some of the matters that we deal with as well. And the last point is, and I think a lot of people alluded to it already in the print media section, is the greater spread of ownership and how do we go about achieving a greater spread of ownership as well. Okay, I want to speak a little bit about how we actually go about maintaining and promoting competition in the economy, and what are some of the mechanisms that allows us to actually achieve this purpose as well. We are governed by the Competition Act 89 of 1998, and there are a number of mechanisms in the Act that we will rely on as a commission. And I think the first kind of mechanism I'll speak a little bit about mergers, because mergers in particular I think is quite important in this industry as well. A number of speakers spoke about, for example, you know, the four major printing publishing companies and their kind of concentration in this country as well. So mergers become very, very important as far as preventing concentration is concerned. There are a number of other issues that we deal with when we deal with mergers. It's not just the concentration issues, but it's issues around how do we make sure that if a merger takes place, that we are able to prevent or anti-competitive kind of concentration in those markets as well. So that's the one aspect that we look at, and we also look at the public interest aspect as well. To go back to the first issue of preventing or lessening competition, in addition to concentration, we look at other kind of factors, for example, the ease of entry into this particular kind of sector as well. And we found that, for example, in the print media, cost, for example, is an issue. When it comes to printing your publications as well, there are a high investment cost to kind of printing as well. Having the ability, for example, to print your material during the golden hour, I think is also important as well. The timing of a publication as well is also important as well. And that talks to capacity of printing in the industry as well. We find often your smaller kind of publishers would struggle to find those golden slots in the industry as well. Then we look at, for example, the history of collusion in the industry as well. We look at your kind of bigger publishers as well, and you know, whether they have colluded to fix prices, whether they have colluded to allocate markets, whether they have colluded, for example, in tender rigging as well. So we look at those kind of issues as well. My colleague will speak specifically about a specific example, so I won't kind of touch a lot on the example. Maybe just you know, kind of the overview as well. As far as concentration is concerned, I know one of the speakers did allude to an example in Dalkor, Goldnet News. And this is basically a typical case of where a established publisher, because of the sheer scale of economics, is able to snuff out some of the smaller kind of publishers. And this is a case of predator pricing. Predator pricing is basically a simple scenario where a established publisher can use, for example, one of its subsidiary kind of publications, for example, to kind of cost below variable cost. So they would take the loss in the short term, kind of exit the competitor, and then in the long term start to kind of raise the price. So that's a typical case of predator pricing. And we are basically seized with that matter at the moment. So we look at other dynamics as well in the market. We look at, you know, kind of growth in the market. We look at innovation in the market. So there are a number of other factors that we will look at as well in the market. And we'll also take into account, you know, whether merging parties, for example, whether companies are actually failing, and how do we actually help to save these companies as well. As I mentioned earlier as well, the one big issue that has really come up in merger kind of matters before the tribunal is the public interest issues as well, and especially employment as well. So we kind of look seriously at, you know, whether retrenchment and loss of jobs is merger specific, and we kind of make sure that we include conditions on those mergers when it comes to those aspects of merger. Another kind of public interest issue is looking at the ability of SMEs and the privacy disadvantage and how they are able to kind of compete in that market as well. So that's far as mergers are concerned. And the other kind of mechanism that we learn a lot in the Act is what we call enforcement. And we've kind of got two divisions in the Commission that deal with enforcement. One is your typical kind of department that deals with your horizontal relationship. So basically, we would look at businesses that are in the same line of business, and we kind of look at how they have, for example, fixed prices, for example. We've got a division, a newly established division called Cartel, that basically look at all these horizontal relationships. And then we have a division called Enforcement that deals with all the vertical kind of relationships. For example, between a manufacturer and a supplier as well. So we look at those kind of relationships as well. Then the third kind of matter that we deal with from an enforcement perspective would be abuse of dominance. And I think that word was used a lot today by previous speakers, so I want to touch a little bit about abuse of dominance. Now, there are obviously guidelines set in the Act itself in terms of what is a dominant kind of company. And the guidelines is between, you know, share market of between 35% to 45%, and whether within that kind of share market, whether they actually have a market power. And by market power, it's simply their ability to kind of control prices, exit competitors from the market. And we've seen already that with established printing companies, they are able to exit kind of smaller parties from the market through aggressive pricing, for example. So that's basically the typical definition of kind of dominance. And Adeen will speak a lot about some of our recent complaints where dominant companies have used, for example, what we call a fighting brand to exit smaller kind of firms from the market. I think it's very important for us as well within the context of this presentation to also mention, you know, what's the kind of legal framework, what are the different layers of, you know, the courts and the institutions in which we operate as well. And also mention what are some of the challenges at the moment to kind of reaching a stage of maturity for competition law and competition law enforcement as well. I think it's important for us to highlight to the committee what are some of our kind of challenges as well. So firstly, I think is we've seen the five layers of investigation and adjudication as well. The commission itself is an investigative kind of organ. The tribunal is what we call a prosecuting kind of organ. And then above the tribunal, we have the Competition Appeal Court, which is equivalent to a seat of the High Court. And above the Competition Appeal Court, also got the Supreme Court of Appeals, and the last layer is Constitutional Court. Now, in recent times, you know, there have been a number of decisions, and I think it has been, you know, in the media as well, where there's been a number of challenges on some of our cases, in particular around procedural issues as well, which has unfortunately, you know, the impact of constraining some of our investigative abilities as well. The Commission has made a decision where we are challenging some of these cases right up to the level of the Constitutional Court. Now, some of the kind of limitations on our mandate as well, and I think the previous speakers did allude to, you know, for example, the viability of competition law in social issues, for example. You know, how do we help to promote social issues as well? And we've seen that some of the limitations, you know, would include, for example, you know, our ability to have an impact, for example, on in labor law as well. That's clearly excluded from our mandate. Our mandate speaks a lot about, you know, economic activity having an effect within the country, or a behavior that has an effect from outside within the country as well. So I want to give an example of, for example, behavior that has an effect within the company. A typical example would be where a firm operates outside the borders of South Africa, but they sell their products and their services within the borders. So we'll find that we would have jurisdiction to look at that conduct anti-competitiveness. And then the Act itself also enjoins us to kind of work with other regulatory bodies, especially where we have concurrent jurisdiction. And we have, to some extent, worked with other bodies within South Africa. ICASA is one of the regulatory bodies that we have a memorandum of understanding with, and we do work with them as well. And I think it's important that where there is concurrent jurisdiction, that there must be a greater need for regulatory organs to actually work together. I think that has become one of the critical issues for us from a stakeholder. At this stage, I'll just hand over to my colleague.
Thank you. This is how we understand the value chain of the print media sector. So you would have, we have newspaper publishers who print, who would have the sort of printing capacity, and there's various ways of printing. And I think for print media, mainly we find that the cold set printing component is quite critical and the one that is commonly used in South Africa. And then there would be distribution of those media via different means, directly to retailers or using third-party distributors. So we have, through our investigations, identified content in this value chain. So there are specific cases that we would have investigated at the commission. Mainly in printing, we have some investigations there. There are ongoing investigations on competition between the publishers themselves. There are investigations that we are doing in relation to the distribution component of the value chain. So this is a sort of a snapshot of some of the investigations we have. So this is it. These are complaints, as my colleague Oliver indicated. We, through our enforcement function, we investigate aspects like price fixing and abuse of dominance. So you would have complaints coming to us from third parties, and these would be complaints that we take forward. The key complaints that are there at the moment is the predatory pricing case against Media 24. This is a very welcome case that was referred to earlier. We also have the case against Afusa Bay and Kodi Beru of Circulation of Standards, as well as all other members of that association. That case relates to price fixing / fixing of trading conditions. There are some rules there that govern sort of this, the pricing of various publications that we are currently investigating. I can zoom into, I think this welcome case is quite, it sort of indicates the issues that various stakeholders have already raised on the sort of form of the abuse of dominance that a number of community newspapers face in this market. That case would be predatory pricing in this form. It would be where a dominant company, in this case, we have already indicated the name of the company over there, would set the price of advertising, below cost with a view to force the exit of a competing newspaper, meaning that that small community newspaper, if a big company continues to price at a level which is does not even assist it in recouping its costs, a competing firm cannot survive in those instances. And advertisers, by nature, they would go for the lowest price. But in our experience, the strategy in the long run is not beneficial to the end user. I think this here would be advertisers. What you find is that a dominant firm would, after the exit of that player, would increase prices to recoup all the losses that we made before. So we have many cases, not in media, even in other sectors, not just South Africa, even in Europe, Australia, the US, there are many such sort of examples wherein after that company has exited the market, there is that recruitment that you see in the market. So we have a similar case in Pietermaritzburg. Still is against a major publisher. So same tactics, same market segment. In this case, we should be your community newspaper segment. So those are the sort of issues that we observe. From our measures front, we have seen a number of acquisitions. I think this is a point again that was made, that I think it was made by AIP, that most of the sort of smaller newspapers are being acquired by major banks. In most of these cases, what we have observed is that in this, say, Media 24 would have a 50% stake already in a company. So when they acquire those banks, the change in the market is not that substantial in many sort of instances, because already they would have been a part owner in that sort of business. So you would notice that a lot of these acquisitions, although they come through to the competition authorities, I think in the past we have approved most of them, because we have to observe a legal standard of a substantial lessening or prevention of competition. A recent case that we worked on, it was a merger between Media 24 and Natal Witness. In this transaction, we did observe some concerns on printing slots, especially the golden hour slot that publishers require in order to compete effectively with their rivals. In that particular case, we have asked, it's a case that is going to go to the tribunal. We have asked for Media 24 to divest a stake in one of the companies in the target sort of entity. In this way, we hope that if that remedy is implemented, competition would be sustained in that particular region in KZN. So in summary, these are the issues that we have picked up. The main one is the concern that relates to the ability of small or historically disadvantaged firms to compete effectively in the entire value chain as we presented earlier. In the main, the concerns relate to exclusionary behavior through abuse of dominance. The main issue, the main form of abuse that we are observing is this predatory pricing scheme that dominant firms tend to adopt. And in more general terms, you would observe these strategic reactions by incumbents that impede entry. And we have mentioned before the issues of the golden hour slot. And in our investigations, we even get indications that the reason a newspaper like This Day could not survive was with constraints with regards to printing in the golden hour slot, especially for a daily, it becomes more critical. There are also issues of bundling that we have observed, where these basically, because most of these majors are basically integrated. So what they offer to a package which they offer would encompass your distribution, your printing, and eventual publishing. So they could potentially there be some cross sort of subsidization that might affect the viability of those firms that are not basically integrated. So, but we do from time to time look at these issues, and they are some of the sort of key competition issues we pick up. And in total, we are of the view that these stratagems by themselves threaten the viability of small community newspapers and their ability to attract advertising, which in our view is a key revenue source for any publisher. And how this links to diversity, we think, at least from the competition authorities' view, we, through major control, we can help in preventing the increased concentration in the print media sector, and that entry of new players would be possible as those markets could not be any more concentrated than the levels that we have now. We also think that there is a need, and it is such a critical issue, for competition in the provision of information to the public. This should be accessed by all, but as other speakers have pointed out, this market is still dominated by very few basically integrated media houses. Entry barriers in themselves affect the entry and expansion of emerging enterprises. At this moment, we do not see signs of effective competition in printing, in the procurement of advertising, as well as distribution. So this applies to competition between major media houses, as well as competition between community, independent community newspapers, and those community newspapers owned by major media houses. And without effective competition and diversity in media, there are adverse effects on the following matters of public interest, at least in our view. issues of content plurality, development of niche newspapers at national, regional, and local level, catering for different communities, giving coverage of news across the country, and also because this is a medium which could improve the levels of education, we think even such opportunities are denied without effective rivals in this market. And in conclusion, we think issues of printing could be addressed by more investment by private enterprises and also some intervention from a public point of view. We are not sort of specific here, given the sort of these are sort of broader policy sort of considerations that we can engage further on. Support for community newspapers, especially in remote areas, catering for different language needs. Support for independent publishers. And from our point of view, we think there's also a need to for a deeper understanding of the competition dynamics in the print media sector. With the cases that we have investigated, we have some ideas on how competition works, but there could still be more work also from our side on this sector to fully understand the constraints and also come up with remedies that could take the sector sort of on a competitive trajectory and allow more enterprises to freely compete in this sector. Thank you, and that concludes our presentation.
Thank you very much, Competition Commission. You see your recommendation moving forward. They are good. But they don't seem to be telling us what you can do yourself in terms of dealing with this matter. I will tell you why. Comtas Report 1996 raised most of the issues we are talking about. It means to remain as a country from 1996 until up to today. We have effectively not dealt with the Comtas issues raised. That's why on my opening I said that report is talking about the anti-competitive behavior or practices, in particular in the print and distribution. I appreciate that you are battling with this matter, but I don't hear you firmly indicating in terms of how to deal with this matter. So what it will mean that from 1996 until up to today, you can imagine. What I'm finding satisfaction with is that most of the issues we are raising now is confirm that really if you want to get things, you must go to people. Because the oversight we've conducted has just been spot on in terms of the issues we are raising and other things that we have raised. So my only question would be that what are the same, what is it you can do firmly to move forward? I've seen your cases, and I understand people, they also approach you, but some of these things are expensive. You don't have a deep pocket. You just, along the way, fall off. But maybe you respond to that. Members, questions? Honorable Drogen and Honorable Zondi.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just for me to get clarity, just to give me some examples of your terms, please. You spoke about
I wanted to ask, there's no better term than but it's okay, the one which is used, predatory, it's okay.
Yeah. Can you just explain that term to me, please, and give us an example? And then?
Inducement.
Okay, explain that term as well.
Fixing of trading conditions.
Give us an example of that as well. And then fixing of newspaper posters. Okay. Fixing, just explain those terms to me, please. And I'd like to know as well the fines that you have given thus far. Because big companies, as we heard, obviously they can afford to pay these fines, and maybe they've budgeted for these fines as well. So, fines, what are the fines that you have given? What companies have you given fines? And then we've also heard one case, as you said, in Valcom, there was an example. The case has now, the community newspaper has now closed. So we'd like to know, now that the community newspaper is closed, does the case just thrown out, or is it still being investigated and so forth? Does the effect that the fact that it's closed, do you still continue with that case? Thank you.
Honourable Zondi.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the term predatory aptly describes the kind of behavior of those who are dominant. I don't think if we're trying to soften it, we would have this the same effect. Coming to question, I just wanted to know if the Competition Commission is a takes a proactive stance or simply wait until it is approved, because there is also a question of accessibility, there is also a question of people knowing where the commission is located in case they have got problems. The second one, in the kind of cases that you have flighted in your presentation, what sort of outcome has been achieved? Did they change the conduct, the unpalatable conduct of the aggressor? That sort of thing.
Honorable Chairman.
Thank you, Chi. I just want to ask, it is indicated that the Commission still requires a further and a better understanding of print media and the dynamics within that sector. But we see that they have had complaints referred to them now for quite a large number of years, since 2004, according to the schedule. My question is, what measures have you taken to make sure that you understand the sector better? And secondly, why is it that we see that these cases are taking so very long? Which is also one of the complaints that we heard about earlier this morning about the Valcom case. By the time that the complaint has actually finally gone through the process, it's in any case too late. To rescue a company, and then just a clarification of the case status. If you have there listed the different status of the different cases, and I see under investigation number 9, you have started as a Competition Commissioner. You started an investigation into Avisa Media. But it is still under investigation, and it started last year in February already. And then there was one month later, there was one referral, recommended for referral. So where are the blockages? What we called roadblocks yesterday, Jacob. Where are they?
the roadblocks? Why is it that for that reason that there was a good motivation made out this morning? And what is your view of that? That there should be a separate anti-competitive commission set up for the print media, or do you think you have acquired, you will acquire the necessary skills to understand the sector? Thank you.
The qualification is that the roadblock in the right road, because there might be a roadblock, but it's not the correct one we are using. You can respond to the question.
Thank you, Chair. Bujinadin and I will try and cover all these questions. I think the first question was around issues that was to explain, for example, predator pricing. Predator pricing is basically where a dominant firm wants to do everything in its power to exit a smaller firm. And for example, in the Balcom case, just to maybe explain what happened there as well and understand it within that context, is that you'd find the local kind of newspaper was not able to compete with the dominant firm, because the dominant firm had two other kind of newspapers in the Balcom area, and it deliberately used one of the newspapers to price below variable costs. In other words, that newspaper would have been running at a loss for many, many years. And it's quite obvious what Adrian said as well, is that you'd find that advertisers will, obviously because they are price takers, they would go to the cheapest publisher for advertising. So what would happen is that you would find that the smaller newspaper over a long period of time would not be able to compete because their cost structure is much higher. And when that smaller newspaper exits the market, the larger publisher will revert back to trying to recoup the losses, and they would automatically increase their prices to an inflated level where consumers would obviously now start to pay a much higher price for example, advertising. So in a nutshell, that's what predator pricing is all about. Then the other issue was around, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I'm not answering this in kind of order, but I'm trying to cover all the questions. Okay. The other question was around penalties, around fines. For example, the Act itself is very, very specific in terms of how much a fine we can recommend. As a commission, we only recommend fines. The discretion lies with the competition tribunal itself, who either accept or not accept the recommendations that we made. Now, the Act itself says it's up to 10% of the annual turnover. Now, we find that in a number of cases, the law has been expanded a little bit. There's the issue of turnover versus affected turnover in that particular sector. You'd find that a number of companies, have raised the issue of, for example, especially your kind of larger companies, your listed companies, where they have diverse kind of businesses and they operate in different segments of the market or in different sectors, and it would allege, for example, that the anti-competitive behavior is in this particular sector, so it does not affect the other sectors, for example. And so the kind of concept of affected turnover has now crept into the law. So one would find the turnover in that particular sector might be much lower than the annual turnover of the entire company. So one of the reasons why, for example, you find that the penalties nowadays are on affected turnover rather than total turnover. And as some examples, we would find, for example, in the food industry, there were companies that was fined up to 200 million, and there were a lot of recommendations on how the money gets distributed as well. We are busy seized with matters in the construction industry as well. And to give an example of, I know the question was asked around, whether we do proactive work as well.
We do a lot of proactive work. Although we are waiting for some amendments to the legislation to allow us to do full-scale market inquiries, we are still constrained by the law, but we still do research into markets. We do have a section in the commission that does research into markets, and for example, the construction sector was one of the industries in which we did research, and our research was telling us that there was widespread collusive tendering in that particular market. In fact, at the moment, we are seized with investigations against 21 firms in the construction industry, and many of, in fact, all of the large construction firms are being investigated in that particular kind of sector as well. And what we've done in that particular example is that we kind of use a different model of how we need to investigate. We realize that investigation would take a very, very long time to investigate 21 companies in the construction industry that have been involved in any competitive behavior from the early 2000s would probably take 5 years to do. So what we've done in that particular case is that we have sent out an invitation for these firms to come and settle on many conditions. And one of the conditions was, number one, is that they needed to fully cooperate with the commission. Number two is that they should cease that anti-competitive behavior immediately. And if with their full cooperation and disclosure, we would look at the specific sectors in which they have contravened the act, and we would look at penalizing them in those specific sectors. So as far as the act is concerned, we can only go up to 10% of the annual turnover. So we cannot go more than 10%. But in a recent case, in the Southern Pipeline case, the judge in that particular case spoke about affected turnover, but he also alluded to the fact that one can go above the 10%, but provided you don't breach the cap of 10% of the annual turnover. So as much as you may penalize a company more than 10% of the effective turnover, but you cannot breach the cap of the 10% of the actual turnover. Then just also on the proactive side as well, as far as cartel investigations are concerned, and cartel investigations are extremely difficult investigations to do. You look at the typical definition of cartel activity, it's basically an agreement between two parties, for example, to fix prices. And that's what the commission has to prove. And I would kind of describe cartel activity very similar in the vein of organized crime activity, which is not easy to investigate. It does take a long time to investigate, especially due to the fact that cartel members often would conduct or achieve these agreements in secret. And securing the evidence to prove cartel activity is extremely kind of difficult. So what the commission has done is we have, in the last few years, created a special policy called the Corporate Leniency Policy, where we invite companies to actually come forward and, in a sense, blow the whistle on cartel activity. And the company that comes first through the door normally would qualify on certain conditions for leniency. So when we do refer them to the competition tribunal, the first company through the door will get a certain level of leniency, but on condition that they blow the whistle on all the other cartel members that were involved in the cartel activity. So that has really expedited a lot of the work that we do around cartel activity. Thank you. There was a question on what can the commission do, and I can link that with the sort of further and better understanding of the sector and how we approach investigations and inquiries into this sector. In the last
cycles, sort of from 2006, 2009. The commission took a strategic sort of decision to start prioritizing sectors, looking at areas where we would make the greatest impact. And arising out of that exercise, we identified four sectors, which were the financial services sector, the food and agro-processing sector, intermediate industrial product sector, as well as infrastructure and construction. So that work in itself is when we get to be proactive. So we undertake detailed scoping studies on a sector, identify key competitive issues that we have to do. And I'll give an example. In the case of the financial services sector, we did a market inquiry into banking, a quite detailed process. And coming to print media, when you say further and better, we received complaints. Yes, it's one of the cases, I admit, it's one of the cases where, sectors where we have not prioritized for proactive investigation, at least on that cycle. But it's we can still take investigations as outlined there. And we just don't want to take these sort of competing issues that we've picked up for granted and assume that that is sort of the landscape that we have. So when we say further and better, and hopefully with all these powers being entrusted to the Commission on conducting detailed market inquiry coming into the fore, we can be able to engage more on the sector and find remedies that would address these
confusing
anti-competitive issues. And on the now, we cannot, you know, outside the cases that we are investigating, there isn't sort of further proactive work that we are doing as at this moment, that the sector is not within our priority sector for proactive investigation. And the cost of the system, Oliver indicated the sort of stages on which where the competition commission is, where the competition tribunal is, where the appeals court is, all the way to the constitutional court. But the cost to the complainant, the complainant does not pay. So if a company lodges a complaint, there's no fee for that. If there is merit to that case, when we refer the case to the tribunal, the commission bears the cost, the legal cost of that investigation. The cost to the complainant would be, as cases take different forms, would be if there's any discovery request where we need to look for further information within that firm, or whether that firm has to prepare submissions to the commission, then I think those are the sort of costs that they would incur, but they will not incur litigation costs if they are taking those investigations forward. In terms of the fines we have collected so far in this 2010-11 financial year, we collected about 700 million in penalties, and the highest being the fine levied on Pioneer Foods, which was, I think, in the region of 500 million. On the status of the case, whether we are taking too long, or whether there are any bottlenecks that we are encountering there. the investigations that we conduct, especially these abuse of dominance investigations, predatory pricing, for example. You don't understand, this would be an adversarial process where a party, a defending party would be wanting to show that what they have done does not contravene the act. And it's a factual inquiry which requires us to do significant investigations, even for us to quickly understand the issue. And I must say, by sort of international standards, I think we are rated.